You're listening to The Printcast, a podcast about the expanding world of printmaking today. I'm your host, Nick Naughton. The Printcast brings you interviews with some of the best contemporary printmakers, sharing anecdotes, business ideas, and technical tips with listeners everywhere. It's like print porn for your ears. I'm coming to you today with yet another recording from my trip last fall to New York City with the owner of the renowned Brooklyn screen printing studio, K-Rock. His name is Carl LaRocca. When I had my print shop, K-Rock was always a studio I studied for ideas on how to make a more engaging and diverse business model, and especially when it comes to making a business reflect what you believe in. In 2016, LaRocca and his crew produced lots of print goods with political messaging, much of it endorsing Bernie Sanders in his run for president. And they've worked with lots of other organizations and politicians and thinkers and people, becoming sort of a de facto New York source for political printed matter. They do custom work, share resources, and everything I see come out of K-Rock is top-notch. You may remember from my previous guest, Leslie Duguid of Duguid Press. She worked there for a time before moving on to Powerhouse, which we talked about. Along with running his shop, LaRocca is a father, a practicing artist, and generally a guy who keeps applying his brain and aptitude to everything he does. We get pretty nerdy on this one. You'll love this episode if you're one of my listeners who enjoys the technical stuff about running a shop and screen printing especially. LaRocca shares quite a bit on like how they work with artists, how he built his company up to where he has 6 full-time staff members now. We discuss polygons extensively, including Carl's favorite, and today's Let's Get Technical is one of my favorite iterations of this segment yet to date. So Carl shares a little gem of a tip, and I promise that if you hear it, you're going to deploy it at your own studio, and I'm going to do it at Paper Chase Press where I work, so you'll have to listen to hear what it is. I'm sure you're all aware now that SGCI has been postponed this year due to the coronavirus. I know that here in the States, it might not seem like a big deal yet. There's not a lot of people who are carriers of the virus yet. And I know that you're all loaded up on masks, which you kind of don't need yet. And for some reason, everyone's buying all the toilet paper. I don't know if I get that. And there's probably plenty of capacity to make more, so I don't know what people are thinking with that. But anyway, it's a serious situation. And from what I've read about it in Italy, what's been going on there, it's really the collective danger that I think is the most important thing to keep focus on, you know, and the danger that the virus poses to like people who have pre-existing conditions, the elderly, and how, you know, easily transmittable the virus is also. So it's like, if you feel bad, like you shouldn't go anywhere. So I understand how this all came about, and I commend SGCI's board, you know, for taking it all in and making a swift decision, because I think it was probably the right one. And it would have had to been made at some point coming up here, too. So I know lots of you out there were looking forward to visiting the island and communing with your print compatriots. I definitely was, and I was hoping to meet a lot of you. So we'll just have to convene and talk in digital format for now. But hopefully, you know, maybe Puerto Grafico will happen at a later date. So we will see what happens with that. I will update you all on the feed, on the podcast feed, so make sure you're subscribed and following. Like, I'll give you little updates to kind of help just kind of share the knowledge and spread the word. I like doing that with this show. Look for updates as I get them. It might not come as even a full episode. I'll just, like, shoot out little bits of information, which, you know, people can take or leave. So, thankfully, also, I wanted to report that I have an inaugural Patreon donor. I'm very excited that someone bought in at the cup of coffee level, and it just really thrilled me. It was like kind of like this highlight of a whole day that day. So also been getting some good feedback, you know, like just like shout outs and people reaching out on Instagram, and it, you know, it's been really cool. So keep it coming and subscribe, you know, do the thing on iTunes where you rate me really well and say nice things. But anyway, let's get on with the podcast. So I hope you enjoy this while you're doing things, you're in the studio, you're driving somewhere, whatever you're doing. Let's get on with the podcast. So without further ado, K-Rock.
I mean, it's just so much fun to have an artist in the studio and then try to understand what their process is, what they're trying to do with their art, and then show them the techniques that I've learned over the years and figure out a way to mesh those two together. It's like that thing, if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Like,
yeah.
You know, all I know how to do is screen printing, so we screen print everything, and, you know, I know how to program stuff, so if I need something, I generally just make it for myself.
You're listening to The Printcast, Season 2. Another season, another reason to make whoopee.
Sometimes when I'm trying to boil down a person's work and career into a short introduction, I'm defied by the complexity of a guest's career to make up something simple that can capture everything an artist is known for. This is my task for today's guest, Carl LaRocca, artist and owner of K-Rock Screen Printing in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. To list just a portion of the work coming out of his shop, K-Rock runs an almost weekly invitational print publishing program. They sell apparel, products, artist books, and games. They also do outside programming, like the recent collaboration with IPCNY's Pulled in Brooklyn. And all of this doesn't even include the services K-Rock offers, like screen printing for artists, t-shirts and flat stock printing, large format scanning, and live printing too. Additionally, LaRocca has work in the collection at MoMA and the Allen Memorial Art Museum in Oberlin, Ohio. He also teaches screen printing at Cooper Union, further sharing his medium with the masses. I welcome K-Rock to the mic today at the IFPDA Print Fair. Carl LaRocca, welcome to the Printcast.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show. Yeah, I've been really interested to talk to you since we met at the Printed Matter Book Fair in LA.
Right.
And I'm interested in many aspects of what you do, from the political involvement to just like running a successful screen printing business and what it's like working in New York and like the ecosystem here. So we can just kind of touch base about everything. But why don't we start at the beginning and have you just introduce yourself and mention your business, your shop, and like what y'all do.
Sure. Yeah. So my name's Carl. I've been running K-Rock Screen Printing since 1998. When I started in Brooklyn, New York. As you said, we publish fine art editions. We do printing for galleries and artists directly. We also do a lot of political work. And we also print apparel and tote bags and things like that a lot in the art scene, but also fashion and music worlds in New York. Yeah, I don't know. Sorry.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, I kind of covered a lot of it in the intro too, but
you kind of said all that.
Going back to the beginning, like, where are you from and where did you come up and where did you go to school and things like that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I grew up in Philadelphia, right in the city. So it's a big city, but it's also like a kind of small, comfortable town at the same time. You can walk everywhere. I definitely had a lot of people supporting art making as a kid. Like, my mom had made a lot of art as an undergrad, and, you know, as a mom, she was very supportive of creative work. A lot of my teachers in early school were artists. So I definitely, you know, grew up making art, had a close connection to my art teachers and other teachers from a very young age. In high school, you know, I studied a lot of things. I took both AP Art and AP Physics in my senior year of high school, I think.
Wow. Do you think those two, like, sensibilities go together, like math or, like, science acuity with, like, kind of creativity and art? Like,
I think, I mean, certainly in my own art, there's a connection. You know, I've worked as a computer programmer, so I have, like, sort of a very mathy, sciencey brain in a lot of ways, and I think that comes across in the art that I make myself, but I think also maybe specifically printmaking might be a well-suited medium for me because of that kind of way of thinking and problem solving.
Yeah, I have the same sort of background, and I was really good at math and science and not so much in literature and reading. And
yeah.
But it's like, yeah, I think there's something about it because printing is so technical and there's a lot of math involved, actually, that I don't think anyone knows. Like, how much math you have to do for all kinds of random reasons, paper cutting and everything, you know?
Yeah, percentages of pigment and binders. Although then when I went to undergrad, I went to Oberlin College in Ohio, and I wound up being a double major in creative writing and studio art. So that sort of, you know, lends itself to the book publishing we do. And, you know, I think as a writer, as a more like short form conceptual writer, that kind of merged my books I've published in the last few years are much more visual, not text-based.
Are these the ones that I saw like on Printed Matter's website, like the 3x5?
Yeah, like the 3x5 matrix is a good example, because that's every drawing that you can make inside a grid that's 3 pixels wide and 5 pixels tall. So there are 2 to the 15th power drawings. And that involved writing a computer program to help me visualize that book. So, you know, it's like glyphs and like any character you can draw inside that grid is one of the drawings. So there are letters and in the book, but it's a much more abstract. It's not a book you can really read.
Yeah. Like how many pages is that? Like what is that?
It wound up being 15 or 16 pages because that's the format of those books.
But yeah,
sort of the dimension of the book and the number of pages determine how big each pixel would be.
Kind of figuring
out how big the drawings would be to fit inside a book that size.
Yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. And there was another book I saw, it was in my earlier notes, which I think I cleaned up.
Like, it was the 14 polygons one?
Yeah. And that kind of connects to your fine art practice, right? Like in a way, like I saw a very like geometric kind of fine artwork you were doing.
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely like, I've drawn to geometry a lot, and of the regular polygons, I think the 9-sided polygon, the Enneagon, is my favorite polygon. One should have a favorite polygon.
You can say, how do you arrive at like any favorite?
You know. Well, I like 9 because it's the odds are more interesting because they're symmetrical on one dimension, but not the other. They mirror left to right, but not top to bottom.
Yeah.
And, you know, 9 is sort of, a meaningful number in a lot of different systems. It's sort of 8 is very structural and solid, but 9 breaks 8 and it becomes the circle.
Mm-hmm.
Or 9 can be, the 8 directions and plus here is 9.
Interesting, yeah.
You know, so there are a lot of kind of ways that relate to the world.
I'll just put it out right now. The printcast doesn't endorse any polygon over others, so we don't take a stance. Yeah. But
I like that book. I kind of think of it as like a prose poem, like a geometric prose poem, because it's sort of all the polygons aspiring to become a circle, which is, could be thought of as a polygon with an infinite number of sides.
Yeah.
And, by the time you hit 14, they're kind of pretty circular already.
Sure, yeah. Well, how do you balance doing this type of work or, writing algorithms, making fine art and things like that? Like, how do you balance that with running K-Rock? Because K-Rock seems like a pretty big, busy thing.
Right. It is. Well, I have some amazing helpers there. I have 6 full-time staff, and then we have 1 or 2 interns, college interns, who are helping and learning and doing their own projects. So that frees me up a lot. A lot of my time is spent working with the artists that we publish or that we're printing to help them realize their work. And then, I'm definitely pretty impulsive. So, if I get an idea for my own work and I can carve out the time, I'll work on that, or when I have an idea to fix the shop or move these flat files over here, like I'll just drop everything and start doing that.
Yeah.
Sometimes everybody's chasing me around.
It's hard. Yeah. It's hard to balance like your time versus company time.
Yeah.
And when you're doing what you're doing, I think it's easy to have one absorb the other, Have you found that like your fine art output has changed or dropped off or been impacted?
Well, I have a daughter who's going to turn 7 in February. So yeah. I think in the last 7 years, my fine art output has been substantially diminished.
Yeah. Well, that's understandable.
But her fine art output has increased exponentially. Yeah. So net sum of it all.
As my friend put it when he had a son, it's his best like time-based artwork, having a kid. So it's this thing that unfolds over time.
Yeah. But I find like as I... I've been running the business we're in our 21st year now, so there are things that I've figured out how to, as things get more procedural and, I can offload more things that I don't have to be in charge of and focus on the things that really require my attention and hopefully have more time to work on my own art.
Yeah, and that makes sense because if you're around for as long as you have been, you'd have to have good systems in place to grow to the point you're at, right?
Right.
Otherwise it'd just be chaos and like you'd kind of run yourself into the ground at some point along the way and you wouldn't have made it to now,
And the programming comes in. Like I've written our own systems that track all of our jobs that we're working on and all the time we're spending working on them and kind of the workflow through the shop. So we have,
you know, like
custom
data.
Software and we have data on what we're spending our time doing. And
so
that's useful.
That's phenomenal, dude. You should package that up. And
I know I could sell it to like a very specific kind of business.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe. But there's like at least one of those in like every town, you know? So yeah, I was curious about the publishing program, which I think is relatively a recent phenomena, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, we've always printed and published artist editions from the very beginning of K-Rock.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them were more up until, I have to check, but 4 or 5 years ago, they were more of the like very limited fine art editions, you know, like maybe a run of 25 or 30 prints, and they're kind of more expensive. I mean, I say that, you know, in the range of like $250 to $1,000 for a print.
Okay. Yeah.
And, you know, we'd sell them at fairs like this or at EAB Fair. And then I think we were at the first or the second LA Art Book Fair, and we had some of those prints. And then people were like, oh, you know, how much is that poster? And we'd be like, well, you know, it's not a poster. It's like this fancy print by this artist. And, you know, we kind of realized that at something like the Art Book Fair, there might really be a market if we could figure out how to make a more affordable print that was still a fine art edition, you know, an original multiple that an artist had made. If we could make a model that you could just buy it because you liked it, not because it was made by a specific artist. So the idea was to try to make something more, you know, democratic, maybe something so, you know, anybody could become an art collector, you know, no matter what your age or situation was. And also to get somebody to actually have a real print, not a digital inkjet print or...
like a reproduction of
it. Not a reproduction, yeah. Right. So the idea was not, you know, to work with artists to make an original print, not reproduce an existing artwork. So we started trying to figure out how that could work as a model. And like a lot of the standard model is, you know, you'll make the prints and sell them and split the money with the artist, or you'll share the prints with the artist and you each sell them on your own.
Yeah.
So since we were trying to sell more prints at a lower price, we were opting to give the artist a chunk of the prints and we just keep them. And then there's no bookkeeping, to figure out what we owe everybody. And so we, you know, kind of settled on a model and we kind of tried to, I like working if I can constrain certain options and then working within those constraints. So sort of we settled on a fixed format. So they're all 18 by 24. Which makes them very easy to frame, and they're all in a portrait orientation, so we can grid them out on a wall at an art booth.
Yeah, that's really smart, because I've run into that before, where it looks really clean, too, like
right.
The setup.
So, like, we can hang a wall of 50 prints in an hour, because everything's a uniform size that might take an art handler longer if everything was a different size and format.
It's super smart.
And we actually even have a wallpaper that I designed that we print and often put up on our booths that has a secondary function of being a grid that we can use to hang all the art on.
Yeah, you've got it down, man. Yeah. Is there a structure to what the artist can do as far as like color limitation, like as far as quantity of colors? And
right. Well,
like?
We try to keep it to five or fewer, but we break that rule, you know, frequently.
Yeah. But there's no, like, depending. Nobody's there's doing, no, like, 40 colors or something.
Yeah, so, yeah, they're not going to be 40-color prints. Probably 8 or 9 is the most that we've done in the series.
Okay.
But they're all priced the same, no matter how many colors they are, who the artist is. So we just try to keep it equal like that.
And what is that price?
So they're $75 a piece,
unframed.
And... I think we're at about 110 prints now of artists we've published.
Wow.
So it's sort of, we've ramped up this year. We've been doing almost one a week, which is a lot of production.
It's a ton.
We spend more than a week working on one.
Yeah.
So we have multiple prints in production simultaneously.
Yeah. Do the artists have a certain amount of time to work up their idea, or how do you end up like arriving at who gets to do a print with you actually?
Right. Well, we have my wife, Kristen Sheila, is a painter, and she's been curating a number of the artists with me recently. Mm-hmm. In the past, I've had other people worked with me curating some of the artists. But we have a big spreadsheet of everybody that we're in conversation with. So, there are lots of people we've reached out to, and then there are ones who are actually actively working on their project. And then, once it gets to the point where we're in production, we might have multiple people in production at the same time. Sometimes they're in the studio, like really hands-on. Sometimes if, it's a West Coast artist, we might be, drawing down color swatches and then mailing it to them for approval and then printing them and then shipping them the prints to sign. In New York.
So you give half the edition to the artist and then they can sell them.
Right. They can sell the prints on their own, or they can wait till we sell ours and then sell them for more if they want to.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah. Do they have to agree to like keep the same price point as you, or?
No, we let them do what they want.
Do
with
what
it.
They want.
But
oh, interesting.
We just agree that we'll sell ours for that.
Because, I always felt mysterious when I was running my shop. It was like, we toyed with this idea like all the time, because when you have the capability to just make things freely for really affordably when it's like in-house production,
right.
It always seemed confusing to me that if I gave half an edition to someone in the same city, potentially we're competing for the same buyers, we're, competing for the same collectors and things like that.
Right.
So it always seemed like this murky thing I couldn't really figure out, and I didn't, it's like, who do you ask about this? It's like, there's not a whole lot of people in the world you can get, support or insight or recommendations on how to go about this relationship. But it seems like what you're doing works really well.
Yeah. Cause especially if they're just our prints, then we can go to a fair and, the money I'm paying to be in the fair, I don't have to consider that I'm giving half of the sale to the artist. Mm-hmm. On top of that, that makes sense, kind of. And then also, like a lot of artists, like a lot of my personal art collection I have from trading works with other artists, or my wife trading. So, having prints, lets you trade prints with other artists to collect more work. You also, a lot of times artists are invited to benefit auctions, and, having something like a print that you can donate, or donate a frame print.
Sure, yeah.
Helps them out too.
Those are all good things. Now, I know, like in your studio, probably over a number of years, you've done a lot of like really political work.
Uh huh.
And I was a big fan. I think I caught, maybe that's when I first became aware of you. I can't remember when I first saw your stuff, probably on Instagram. But I think I saw you were like a Bernie supporter in the last election.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you made some like some funny like shirts and stuff. And I mean, everybody was kind of politically engaging. It was it was more disorganized than like the Obama kind of push, where like all, like so many artists were all working in one vein to push forward.
Right.
Which I always think is like such a marvelous time.
Yeah. I think a lot of the first, during Bush, we were printing a lot of, we had a t-shirt we printed a lot of, and we did a lot of work with Downtown for Democracy at that point, publishing a lot of art editions for them that they sold. And then sort of during Obama, it was like 8 years of not really being so stressed about politics, which, even though there were things to be active about, it wasn't a crisis. And then with this last election, we did a lot of printing for Bernie. That shirt, the Bert Ernie Bernie shirt you're talking about, was actually designed by an artist named Daniel Davidson, who I've done work with. And so he donated that design.
Man, that's awesome.
And then, we donate a lot of money to Bernie, enough so that now all the progressive candidates think we're some kind of big political donor and will ask us to buy seats at a table. I'm like, no, it's just like we sold this shirt and, we're supporting him, but we don't, I'm not a, I don't have disposable cash just to give to politics. But we've had some phone calls with some local progressive politicians because of all that Bernie supporting.
That's got to be cool. Like, I've always thought if there was like an arena to like pivot and work in, it would be so fun to work in like kind of branding and kind of like what Obama like somehow had put together. Because I knew people at the time when he was running. I knew people. There was a guy named Yossi Sargent, actually, who we worked with kind of for an unrelated thing in Kansas City. But he had come from L.A. to Kansas City for this event, and he was like working there. And basically, he was one of the people like running like the creative machine behind Obama. And he was like coordinating with like tons of like huge big name artists and like getting them to like kind of put out this work that, you know, so much of the work like Shepard Fairey is like, you know, iconic.
Like that Hope poster.
The Hope poster. And there was just like this force kind of behind what was happening at that time. And it's always been lost to me as to why like Hillary didn't try to assemble the same sort of movement behind her. Maybe it was just a different candidate, different situation, different election.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more like youthful energy behind Obama than Hillary. And, you know, I, you know, supported Hillary in the end, but I would have much preferred to have Bernie as the candidate last time.
It'd be interesting to see what would have happened. But I was curious, like, whether, like, what good or bad effects come from this political work? Have you had any, like, pushback from people? Has it affected, like, business or grown business or?
Yeah, well, at one point we had some trolls attack our email because of the political stuff. And they actually, there's a. They basically did a script where they signed us up for every single mailing list in the world. And then you get a confirmation email from every single mailing list in the world, and your inbox is completely unusable.
Holy cow. Is that doxing? Is that what?
Or doxing is when you publish somebody's identity. So if you, that's like publishing somebody's home address, like a reporter.
That's different.
But yeah, I guess that's sort of like a denial of service attack on your email. But mostly since Trump, you know, I guess since like election night, we started publishing a lot of t-shirts and tote bags. And we came up with the idea that you could decide where you want to send your contribution. So we have about 10 different charities that we've pre-selected, and then you could pick from it. And then sometimes we've invited artists to contribute to that project, and if they want to submit a new charity, we let them add that into the list.
Oh, that's really cool.
So, you know, you can donate to Planned Parenthood or the National Resource Defense Council for the Environment, or ACLU, you know, the kind of usual suspects. There's the Coalition Against Gun Violence. You know, I've made a shirt that I, it seems like every day I wear the shirt, there's a shooting, but it's, now is exactly the right time to talk about gun control.
Yeah, shirt. Absolutely. And, I think there's,
so,
yeah, it's something that it's bizarre to me how little change has happened given like all of the events that take place and how especially like some of the bigger ones in recent months, like when they happen and you hear about it and you hear the details and you see it play out in the news. And it's like within that week, like two or three other things, you know, shootings can happen.
Right, exactly. Like with El Paso just like, happening.
Yeah. But it's like, it leaves you reeling and you don't know what to do, but it's like, we're all kind of powerless to do anything from the top down. Like it's up to like the system to take action, but no one does, you know? And it's frustrating, but I like knowing that you're trying to do something like on this other end. And it's what other people have been proposing, because we're kind of beating our head against the wall, like in a number of ways, given the current climate and everything, you know, and trying to just create change and like order in the world. And some people are doing these things now where like, you to make something better happen. It's like you donate to a cause that you want to like support to like create a notion of good, you know?
Right. Actually, that you mentioned climate, the shirt I'm wearing today is I made for the global climate strike. And I kind of feel like that's the most important thing for us to be working on right now, because we've sort of like wasted 4 years that we really can't afford to waste right now with the climate.
I know. And every day almost I'm like seeing like a video of like, you know, like a glacier just like disappearing, you know, like a time lapse and things like that. And it's like I don't understand how people can deny that it's happening when there's just like easy evidence to find.
Right.
You know, you can see like pictures of like mountains and things from like 40 years ago and like today that are, they're just like bald without ice, but they used to have glaciers covered.
Yeah. For, and when like the cigarette companies, you know, Exxon knew about this in the 80s. And,
yeah. You know. It's bizarre, but I like that you have this power with your shop to do something. And so you're doing things that fit in your wheelhouse, but like they go far beyond, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, printmaking has such a history, you know, of being a tool for political change, you know,
definitely. Yeah.
Back from like WPA posters and, you know, and we're doing some work with local candidates too. Like there was this guy, Suresh Patel, who was running for the Senate two years ago that we did a lot of work with his campaign.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing some work with AOC's.
AOC.
with AOC for the Green New Deal, sort of making some WPA style posters based on the New York City parks.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
And
yeah, do her people just contact you or do you try to approach
them?
Yeah,
they just got in touch with us.
Yeah. See, that's the ideal. So, like if they're coming to you, like it's hard to make that happen, you know? Like,
mm-hmm.
So what about, I saw a whole lot on Instagram and just like in different feeds about the Pulled in Brooklyn event that happened. And was that, you guys didn't organize that. That was the Print Center.
Right. So that was the Print Center and they invited us we were part of the show because it was all Brooklyn publishers and printers.
Yeah.
So we were one of the people contributing to the show. But then there were sort of two things going on simultaneously. They wanted to do a portfolio for their yearly fundraising gala. So they partnered with us to publish an edition of six artists for that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also happening in conjunction with the Pulled in Brooklyn show. So we kind of did a lot of work with IPCNY last year. We had a live screen printing demonstration at the opening of Pulled in Brooklyn, and but there are, you know, tons of other artists involved with that whole show and with talks during the show. And
who were some of the other like artists and shops involved in it?
Well, like Luther Davis was helped them curate all of the printers. And so he's a printer and publisher at what used to be BRT and is now Powerhouse. Jungle Press was involved.
Fair.
Marina, 10 Grand was involved.
Yeah, for those out there who didn't catch Pulled in Brooklyn when it was taking place, it was April 4th through June 15th of 2019.
It was 26 print shops.
Yeah, 26
it's kind of amazing
print
that there are so many
Brooklyn.
Print shops in Brooklyn now.
Well, it's kind of like that everywhere, you know? Like, print has really, like, found, like, its own voice, I think, finally. Just in the past few years, it feels like it's really solidified. But, you know, I think when I entered into printing, it was, like, the dying art form was the common kind of description of what we were working on. And we were all...
Right.
We were all doing it despite that, but we talked about that being a thing, and now it's kind of expanded to become, I think because of social media, it's like become this new popular thing that, because it's like such a niche art form, everyone's connecting more so through like digital networks,
right?
You know, to share and to learn, to like promote, you know, and it's made things like this show reach everyone across country, across the world almost, you know? But yeah, what all went into the event? It was like a show in two spaces through the International Print Center of New York. And then was there other additional programming? I know there was videos.
Yeah, they made videos with a number of the artists. And then they had artist talks through like every week. Different artists would come in and be in conversation.
Yeah.
And, you know, it involved all sorts of people that I know and have worked with at different print shops in Brooklyn. Yeah, I think they were... The original idea was that the show was too big to do in the gallery space, so they were going to have two shows, one after another, and then they wound up, there was a space vacant in the building that they were able to take over for 3 months and have the show all concurrent.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, I didn't know if
they were expanding. I think it was really better for everything. And I think part of the fundraising from the print edition that we printed with them was to pay for the rent of that additional gallery space.
Oh, nice. Smart. Well, yeah, what's it like working in Brooklyn? I mean, I've only been to Brooklyn a handful of times, right. But I know that the art world in New York has kind of expanded very, very much into Brooklyn area.
Yeah, I mean, I rarely come into Manhattan anymore. This is kind of a treat to come in here. But it's nice. The 7 train's right by my studio. So now that it comes all the way to 34th Street,
I'll shoot
over here on the 7. I mean, Brooklyn, I love Brooklyn. I've been living here since the 90s. Sort of K-Rock started because I had space. And I had space because I'd built out a warehouse with 6 friends. And, we took a raw space and transformed it, and we were living there. And then my friend Bill saw somebody was selling their silkscreen equipment, and I'd done a lot of silkscreen in college, and I'd actually met Bill at the fabric workshop in Philadelphia that does fine art textile printing. So we got this guy's exposure unit and his drying rack and his vacuum table and just started printing out of my space because I had the space. I've been fortunate that we keep being able to find a space in Brooklyn to print in. I've moved the studio. I've been in 4 different locations now, and 3 of them are luxury condos or vacant lots at this point.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah, so, you've probably seen a whole change in that Brooklyn area like over these years.
Yeah, it's definitely changed a lot. I mean, we've been really fortunate that we've always been on the East River, so we always have kind of a connection to the water and, up and down Williamsburg. Now we're in Greenpoint, which it's really fun being up there.
What's it like up there? Is it quieter? Or I guess I saw that you have your space currently is in a building. What is it? It's like a nonprofit that
So it's a nonprofit that wants to keep manufacturing. So it's a lot of stability. Like we know we can stay there. And we have our spaces. We have a pretty decent sized space, and it's, as my 4th studio, it's set up pretty well. If I have a 5th studio, it'll be fun to set that
even
up.
Better.
I'm not looking to move at this point.
It's a huge burden to move and costly and interrupts the flow of everything in a way.
Sometimes I wish I could get some bigger equipment in there, but they're working on a new freight elevator, so maybe once that's put in.
So you don't have a freight elevator currently?
They tore our freight elevator out, and then it's like a 9-month-long project to put a new one in. So now we're working with this construction hoist that doesn't work very regularly. So that's
That's a little stressful. Hairy. Although if you've ever ridden on like some of the old, super old-ass freight elevators, they're kind of...
Yeah, this one was like a 100-year-old, very scary elevator. So it'll be nice.
And I've had them I've been stuck in those before, and it can be a little freaky.
So it'll be a great upgrade once it's done. But they've been promising me the new elevator for 6 or 7 years now. So
wow,
it's nice it's finally happening.
That's kind of wild. Have you? So over time for printing this long. I know for me, like screen printing off and on has kind of given me issues with like chemical exposure and like just kind of feeling some of the process kind of wearing on my body. Like have you had similar effects or have you?
Yeah, I definitely, most of the printing we do is water-based, but we would do occasional, enamel or oil-based process. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I just gave away my flammables cabinet and just stopped doing any work with that because I don't want to be exposed to those solvents. So predominantly we print with TW Graphics water-based ink.
Nice. Yeah, that's good.
And we, on the t-shirts we do plastisol and water-based. We have a ventilation system on the dryer.
That's good.
We try to keep everything as environmentally friendly in the studio as we can. All of our like wash-up stuff is all soy-based and as eco-friendly as possible.
Yeah, do you use the, the Rionet, they have a, like Screen. It's called Screen, I think it's called.
No, we use Franmar. It's like
okay.
I think Beanie Do and Strippy Do and
okay.
I don't know.
Is it kind of like Orange Cleaner and things like that versus like the other more chemical formulated things?
Yeah, so it's supposed to be more environmental. And we have like a really high-tech filtration system on our washout booth. So it goes through all these different mesh filters and then gets pumped through.
Oh, nice.
Down to like 20 microns. So what goes down the drain should be, you know, capturing all the particles and chemicals.
Yeah, like emulsion and ink solids and things all gets captured.
Filtered out.
Nice. Well, yeah, it seems like you figured out how to run the shop, and do you feel like you have, so at this point you have a good like life balance with like running that, and you're able to like have family time and not
A lot of family time, yeah, which is great. And my daughter loves to come and work in the shop.
Oh, that's cool.
She loves to work in my wife's studio too.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I get to exercise and make art and be with my family. And
you live around that area too? Or?
Yeah, I live about 2 miles away from the shop, so I ride my bike most days.
Oh, that's great. That's awesome. Well, what else? So then, what's like next for K-Rock? Like, what do you foresee getting into, like in 2020 or beyond?
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens politically in 2020.
Yeah.
That'll have some bearing on it. I think, you know, for the time being, we're just going to keep publishing editions. We're exhibiting at NADA in Miami in like 2 months. So that'll be our first time exhibiting at Art Basel.
Wow.
I think that'll be fun. And we've been expanding into some more. We've always done art book fairs in LA and San Francisco and New York. But we're going to the Chicago Art Book Fair soon, and we're looking at, you know, trying to do some more exhibiting in Europe, like, you know, in Tokyo or in France or London. So, you know, probably expanding more art fairs.
Yeah.
Just working with more artists. Like, I mean, it's just so much fun to have an artist in the studio and then try to understand what their process is, what they're trying to do with their art, and then show them the techniques that I've learned over the years and figure out a way to mesh those two together to make a print.
I was curious about that. Like, so when you're working with people who like aren't maybe in New York, like some of these people remotely, do you have ways that you convey to them like how to make layers or imagery, or do you just like take what they give, you know, because people could give you like notebook paper with like drawings on it or something if they have really no clue as to what happens.
Yeah. I mean, it's different for every artist what their process is going to be. But I do always try to have them, you know, think about constructing a print as its own thing, mm-hmm. like out of pieces rather than have it, you know, something finished that they're trying to reproduce. So I try to show them all the tools that we have available. Sometimes it's as simple as, sometimes I'll have them make a drawing on a piece of paper and then flip the paper over on a light table or on a window and make a drawing on the back of the paper. And then we have two drawings that are registered to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can scan the two of them and mirror one and layer them back together.
That's a good trick.
Or, you know, sometimes we'll even, you know, if we have something in the computer, I can print out a film and then have them flip the film over and paint on the back with India ink or draw on the back. And then if you scan it, the film's just cloudy enough that you can kind of threshold out the printed thing and just have what they drew. And then you can put those back together and register. So especially if you have somebody, you know, working, you know, often maybe we'll print a couple layers and then they'll want to react to that. So figure out how they can draw, add more layers to what they've already printed.
Yeah. Those are both good ideas. So. Well, yeah. What other? So here, let's jump to. So I usually do a segment at the end, or I'm starting to. It's actually new, but it's called "Let's Get Technical."
Technical.
Ooh. Okay.
And so it's basically to give people like one little tidbit of knowledge that you've picked up over time that has changed and helped your practice. So it's sort of like, what tip, trick, or tool can you not live without in your studio right now? What would you say?
Okay, well, actually, I was thinking about this earlier, and I think we have a way of handling our ink, because often water-based ink, you know, you might have a little clump of pigment in it that will either get stuck in the screen and cause a clog in the screen, or might cause a streak as you're printing.
Yeah, so huge issue, especially when you're mixing like custom colors all the time, right? Like,
and it, you know, we always keep our old inks, and we try to mix new inks out of old inks as when possible. So, so you want to strain your ink before you print, but just straining it with like mesh by hand is like really messy and time consuming.
Yeah.
So what we've discovered is we put our inks into like a food service squeeze bottle, and then we take a little square of old mesh, like, you know, 110 mesh, and put it underneath the cap of the bottle and screw the mesh on. So then you squirt it through the bottle and it strains through the mesh when you put it onto your screen. So one, that's like a really easy way to get ink onto the screen without pouring it and having to deal with drips, but it also filters the ink as you put it on the screen.
Man.
And then, you know, anything that won't go through the 110 mesh, you know, is what would have clogged up in the mesh you're printing.
That's smart. I've had to build like straining systems before because of, you know, I don't know, like one job I had ink that, of course, my friend didn't tell me till like after I'd run the job and just battled with it for days, but he was like, oh, that ink's like 8 years old. And I'm just like, what do you, you know, like the white was like literally like solid chunks in like a liquid.
And totally. Yeah, you can get like those paint straining bags, you know, but
I was using like solo cups and like, and yeah, screen mesh or something I had laying around, and then fumbling and making a gigantic mess with it. And
yeah, so a nice other thing you can do is if you have your inks in those squeeze tubes, like say you're going to print a gradient, you can have all of your inks for the gradient, and you can add a very controlled amount of ink to the screen as you're printing, and you just keep adding a little more ink every couple of runs and get a really smooth fade.
Wow. Yeah, those are great ideas. Do you then, when the job is done, do you keep it in that bottle, or do you?
No, then we take it out of the bottle. We keep them in like cork containers, like food service cork containers, and then we'll wash the bottles out and use them again.
Interesting. Well, what else? I think you probably have more of these things.
Yeah, let's see what another. Actually, one thing I've discovered recently is we do our larger format prints on a one-arm press, like a Cincinnati one-arm.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I found is flooding with the one-arm, it's, you know, when you're flooding by hand, you can leave a kind of thicker ink deposit that won't dry up. But with the one-arm, it's really hard to regulate the pressure on the flood stroke. So often there's too much pressure and it doesn't really leave any ink on the screen.
Yeah.
So I'll actually print with the one-arm, but then I'll use an autopress flood bar and I'll hand flood using like an aluminum flood bar.
Yeah.
And that lets me like both like, you know, if the ink is going to one side, I can really scrape all the ink out very easily and move it around the screen, but I can also flood with a much thicker stroke that'll, you know, resist drying up on press longer, especially since you're moving typically slower when you're printing like a 40 by 50 sheet.
And, yeah.
You know, hand pulling it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Why do they use like an aluminum flood bar on those auto presses versus just like another squeegee or something? Like cleaning it, or?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't need to be a squeegee.
Yeah.
I guess.
Because, I'm with you. Then, like, I never,
and then they also, we have aluminum. We also have stainless steel ones, which are more expensive, but less likely to get a little nick in them.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it's light and thin. And
I always found with like scoop coaters, which are like usually aluminum, I'd always like rehone them from time to time, you know? So I'd take out sandpaper and I would like smooth off the edges just so that your coats are like perfectly smooth. And,
right. So you don't have a little nick with a thicker area.
Yeah. And whenever I was teaching, I don't know if where you teach is like this, but the schools, you know, typically have really rough kind of setups just from like student abuse over years, you know? And so I'd go there and I would like rehone all their stuff just at the beginning of a screen print class, just because I had, you know, because you know what's going to come when like you're trying to show people the basic process, but then like they don't have an ideal setup and they don't have like everything figured out and ironed out technically.
Right. You know? I'm really fortunate because Scott Nobles, who runs the print shop at Cooper, who's the head of printmaking, is like an amazing printmaker and amazing technician. So
see, that's
there are
good
aspects of their print studio that are nicer than mine.
Like, wow. That's what I've been talking to people from like RISD and different schools. I met some people last night and like it sounded like lots of people had great shops. I've worked in some like I've worked in some good ones and then like some really rough ones where I'm like shocked that those are, you know, things are in the state they are. But but yeah, it's usually like the people overseeing it that kind of dictates what's what, you know.
But it's also I mean, one of the things I love about silk screening is how democratic the process is, because, you know, you can just get a screen and, you know, get some pan block out and, you know, paint a screen in your kitchen and print it, you know, without needing any equipment at all.
Totally. Yeah.
Or cut paper stencils. Or,
Yeah. You could just cling like tissue paper, you know, by just printing over it, you know.
So I always try to start my students with those processes. And then we get into photo emulsion a couple of weeks into the semester, but just showing them the old hand ways of making things.
Yeah, I was wondering about like how you structure a class, like a semester long class basically.
Yeah,
and it's all
so like 15 weeks.
Just screen printing.
Yep, just screen printing. Yeah.
How do you convey to them, like to people starting out, like the digital side? Because part of it's really, you know, it's difficult. Like during teaching a 15 week class, you can't teach people how to use Illustrator.
Right.
You know, so how do you navigate that?
Well, students today, you can kind of assume that during foundation, they've learned enough about Photoshop and Illustrator.
Yeah.
But there's definitely a huge range of, you know, of their comfortability, how comfortable they are with those programs. I typically, like, I'll start with us hand-cutting paper stencils and just seeing how ink goes through the screen. And then the idea that you can block part of the screen to not print ink. Mm-hmm. And then I'll move on to using photo emulsion and have them hand-cut just black paper and tape it to Mylar. So then they've gone from sort of a negative process where they're blocking the screen out to where, you know, then what they cut out in the black paper is what will print. Yeah. So they get the idea that then if they make a film, that's, you know, how to make a film and put it on a screen photographically.
Yeah.
And then we'll move into making a, you know, making films with a computer. And then we start doing halftones and more complicated, teaching them about registration. And, from that, I have all of our interns and all of my students do a book project. Cause I think, you know, because I have such a kinship to artist books and printed matter. And, you know, it's not something that everybody does anymore. So,
yeah, it's definitely like, I mean, there's still people out there making artist books. Like, I still see them. And yeah, like printed matter, especially in like the book fair and things they put on. And,
yeah.
Like there's a haven for it, but what draws you to artist books? Like just like your past with like text and writing and things like that. And
writing, but also visual books too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love a lot of artist books, you know, the serial nature of them. I mean, the fact that you can print a whole book on a sheet of paper and then just by virtue of folding it up and sewing it and cutting it, it becomes this two-sided serial thing.
Yeah. And, are you a fan of like what kind of artist books are you drawn to? Like kind of like Ed Ruscha, like 26 gasoline stations.
Yeah, I definitely, I love Ed Ruscha.
I know that's like
one of my favorite
artists.
That's
a favorite.
Yeah, I really, I think the 13 Small Fires and a Glass of Milk, I think it's 13. I really love that one. It's like, you know, like a
or
match
he's made a
and
bunch
a burner.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. Or all the, yeah, like the LA Strip, like the gas stations. And
yeah, all the buildings on the Sunset Strip, I think was the one. And I almost did a project like that at one point, but I felt like it was I didn't have an idea. It was basically what I decided because I was just stealing his idea and applying a new neighborhood to it. But
yeah, and like Saul LeWitt, like I really love Saul's work.
Yeah.
You know, he also is somebody who would take a system, like create a constrained system for himself and then explore every permutation of that system.
Absolutely.
Like, I like that idea.
Like
of
his
art
wall
making.
Drawings.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting medium and it's really its own beast, you know? It's like, because artist books can involve any kind of materiality, you know, like making digitally, hand printing, hand making, collaging, anything. And then there's like the format of the book itself, which can be very sculptural or very, very normal, like every book, everyday books, you know. Yeah.
And I guess it's like, I always loved books as a kid. And then once you realize you can actually just make one, like it always seemed like, oh, you have to have somebody publish your book, but you can just make a book.
Yeah. Give yourself paper and you can just knock them out, you know?
I mean, even now you can, have print on demand, a hardcover book, and just make one of them. It's kind of amazing. Yeah. Like that.
Well, so I work at a bindery right now, and one of the things I learned recently was like that we're like a family-owned bindery, so we actually run all the soft covers and perfect bound stuff like in-house and everything. But I've always thought back to like when I made Blurb books, and I had I had friends who published their own books, and they'd make like a copy and sell some online or something, or and it was very accessible. But apparently, like all of the companies all work with like just one or two major distributors of like bookmakers, like binderies, and they're like huge. And so like they service like all of the companies. So like Blurb and Mac, and I don't even know some of the other ones that are out there right now, but like they all work with like one company basically. They're all just
to actually do the fabrication.
Yeah. The fabrication is all handled by one production firm, but it's like all these different fronts that you can engage with to order the books to be made,
That's interesting.
Which I guess makes sense.
Scale.
Yeah. I think, over time, binding as a thing has really like contracted to where it's like, I think we have like the ones that are around now, maybe will stick around, but there was like a die off of like book binding as a thing.
Right.
Especially because of like the print on demand and stuff that's come about. I think it killed off a lot of the old bindery shops. Like we bought equipment from some that like closed back in the day that, they were set up with like lead type collections and all kinds of stuff. And they had 100 years of work that they'd done. And then it just like, they hit a point where like, it was no longer tenable to run the shop and, continue on,
Right.
But then it like bounces back sort of in a new way.
I know there are things, there are all these things that you used to have printed, like everything you submitted to court would have to be like actually printed and bound and submitted, and you'd have to print 200 copies of this brief.
Yeah.
And now it's all digital.
And like notaries and stuff, like you needed everything notarized in those official settings. It's interesting. Yet print thrives,
Yes.
I don't know. It's a good time for it. Yeah. So I guess, do you have any other, any upcoming publications or projects or books or anything coming out that you'd like to mention?
We have prints that we're releasing, but, that they're just
ongoing,
ongoing.
Yeah.
I haven't released a book for a little while. I need to do that more. The books are like a real labor of love, because somehow, you print this giant piece of paper, but then if you fold it up and cut it, it's, a book is only worth a certain amount of money in somebody's mind. So they're a lot more labor, because you're printing on both sides and cutting it and hand sewing it and printing a cover. So I love working on those projects, but they, break even at best.
Is that the format you use for all the books? Like, what is it called? Is that like a folio or a, I think there's a name for this style of binding.
I think a folio is just a piece of paper folded in half.
Is that? Okay.
And then there's like a folio and a quarto is like a piece of paper folded twice.
Yeah.
I think, I'm like trying to remember like eighth grade Shakespeare. But we sort of have a format that's based a lot. We do a lot of our books are now 8x12, because we can print like 8 pages on a 26x40 sheet of paper.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's sort of based on that, the size paper comes. And so we have like a 6x9 format, I think, where we, I should know the details of this better than math, but
it's all right.
So we kind of have two different sizes of books we make, one that has 16 pages from a 26x40 sheet of paper, and then one that has, I think, 24 or 32 pages from the same size sheet of paper.
Okay.
And then sometimes when we started doing the books, we had a smaller format where we'd actually print on like a 20x26 sheet. And do you know what work and turn printing is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we'd do work and turn. So we'd print two copies of the book. So you print one side on on the left and the other side on the right, and then you flip the paper over.
Yeah.
So that's the way, that's the format I've been teaching my students how to teach, how to make a book. So they, you know, if you want, if you make two screens, you can have a two color printing on both sides of the paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, a lot of the format's dictated by, you know, standard sizes and paper sizes.
Yeah. Which makes sense. Yeah. I mean, that's, I think that's how a lot of stuff has been, has come about to be what it is today. And, you know, like, I don't think most people question like why a sheet of paper is the size it is or something, but,
right.
it's because there's a parent sheet that has a little extra so you can cut off the waste,
right,
and have clean cuts, you know, but it,
yeah, it's always annoying how cover stock is an inch bigger than text stock. Like, you know,
so what is it? 20,
so that's like 20,
23 by 35
or most of it's 2640, but then yeah. The text will be 25 by 38.
Yeah.
And then we use a bunch of European papers too, which, you know, I love the metric system. I've really internalized like kilos and grams, and I'm working on centimeters and meters.
Yeah.
Still Celsius feels really weird to me.
I can't make sense of it.
To know what 22 degrees feels like.
Yeah. People are, you know, you watch like the Great British Baking Show and they're baking at temperatures I can't understand.
Yeah,
they're just like 150 fan. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, it makes no sense. Yeah.
I mean, the cool thing about, I actually think that if we use Celsius, Americans might take climate change more seriously because 2 degrees Celsius doesn't, 2 degrees doesn't sound like much when you're thinking like, oh, 96, 98. But if you think of it as being 2% of the distance between freezing and boiling, it really kind of means something more.
Yeah, that's much more powerful in the framing it like that. Yeah, I don't know why we never went metric. It's like American obstinance, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of, I was, you know, born in the 70s, and that's when they're trying, but it just never really took hold.
Yeah, I remember in school, they would talk about it, and we all, I don't know, we were all aware that it may happen someday, but it, yeah, it, like, never has.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I infuriate my wife because I have my Google Maps set in kilometers, and you know, so I'd be like, oh, take an exit in 15 kilometers. And she's like, what's that mean?
Do I look like I've gained a kilo?
Yeah.
I feel fat. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I can tell you have a very technical mind, mm-hmm. and it's been good for what you're doing, because not only is it a technical process that you do, but your business has benefited, I think, also from some of the structure that you can create and understand. And those internal systems, like, I don't know anybody who's like writing code to like organize their business, you know?
It's, yeah. It's, I don't really know unique. If it's the most economical use of my time, but it's kind of, you know, it's like that thing. If the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Like,
yeah.
You know, all I know how to do is screen printing. So we screen print everything, and, you know, I know how to program stuff. So if I need something, I generally just make it for myself.
Yeah. Well, that's good, but you play well with others. You have people who work for you, and you run a business. It's not just you, you know, which is
right.
Also, that's also like a big hurdle, I think, to cross. Is like, what was it like when you had your first employee or brought someone on to help?
Right. Yeah, that was. Yeah, there's a lot of learning over the years of working with people. You know, I had in the beginning, I started with a friend of mine, and we worked together, and then he went to grad school. And then I brought another friend of mine on who was actually my partner for a long time, until about 8 years ago. And then over the course of that, we slowly grew employees. You know, I've had a number of employees come and go. You know, I think every time we, you know, get new employees, it's a chance to like kind of reevaluate what you want the culture of your business to be. And, you know, 'cause they're coming in and mm-hmm. they're like, whatever they see is their new baseline, you know?
Yeah,
so I think we're constantly, you know, just always trying to, you know, make it a better culture for everybody. I think I've got a great team right now. I'm really proud of all my employees.
Yeah.
And, we're all doing great work together.
Well, it seems like it. I mean, that's a good point to leave off with, but I appreciate you coming to the fair today and making time and yeah, for just all the other work that you're doing, because I think it's valuable, and you're playing into all the things that print is about, you know, including like the politics and the multiple and making it accessible and democratic for people to be able to buy things that are cool and handmade. but not being like out of reach, you know, in price point. So
great. Thanks for inviting me. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for coming on.
You've been listening to The Printcast, a podcast about print shops, the artist, the process, and all the things we make. If you like what you were listening to, help us get the word out by subscribing and leaving a 5-star review and sharing with your friends on social media. You can find The Printcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, as well as on the website printcast.com. Music for the show is by Jazar. Voiceover provided by Jim Birdsall and Rhiannon Birdsall. Take care of yourselves and each other, and we'll see you again on another episode of The Printcast. Bye for now.